Secular campuses are being transformed, but the students need your help. Last year, students at 41 secular universities asked to start TI chapters. Only 10 could be funded. The rest are still waiting. Please, give a student the yes they've been praying for. They're ready, but they can't share the truth without you. Your gift before September 15th can launch a new TI chapter and change lives. Go to ThomisticInstitute.org/donate or use the link in this episode to give today.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
The topic for today, or the topic for this afternoon, or this part of the afternoon, there are various topics at various times, so you have to be specific. Is like, where does the TI fit in my college experience, my being your? So where does the TI fit in your college experience? I suppose we could ask the broader question, like, where does anything fit in your college experience? I don't know if you have this experience, but sometimes it feels like life is kind of so many tasks arranged in chaotic fashion to which you attend on the basis of their urgency. So it's like, this is on fire, time to put it out. That's on fire, time to put it out. But it can be difficult to kind of gain insight into the whole of your life, like how it hangs together, how it's articulated, whether or not it's actually coherent or cogent, or whether you're just doing various things, some of which are edifying and some of which are destructive, and just hoping to do more in the former category than in the latter category. So my proposal is that your life can be, may in fact be, but can be more so, cogent and coherent. And I just kind of want to situate where the TI may fit into that. So I don't want to lean like too heavily upon it, like, this is the only way. You can do various things and go to heaven. So I'm here for it. I'm a big defender of the theological category of the optional. So like when people are like, should I go to daily mass? I'm like, you could. I just get nervous when people are like, you have to do everything always. It's like, oh my gosh, where do naps fit in? So I think the reason for which it's at least somewhat urgent, but helpful at the very least, to answer the question, like, where does the TI fit into my college experience? It's because otherwise we're probably going to just not do it that well, or cut it out, or just distance ourselves gradually in a way that offends the least number of people. Yeah, like, you know how this goes. It's like, wow, this thing is kind of hard, and it takes up a lot of time, and I'm going to have to cut something. And I'm definitely not cutting out my tap dancing lessons, so it's got to be the TI. So I think like part of what motivates the question is if you can begin to understand or appreciate like how all of this fits together and how all of it tends to God, then it becomes easier to give yourself to it. So there are various ways of answering this question. I'm going to refer to the material answer and then the formal answer. Basically, we could point to experiences that are available via the TI, and then explain how those experiences conduce or lead to deeper conversion, maybe the discovery of your vocation. That was actually the case for me. So I was raised in a Catholic family, and my parents love the Lord, and my sisters and brother set an edifying example of Christian life. But I didn't really like know how life fit together. I had some vague sense as to like this was good, and that was good, and the other thing was good, but I just didn't see quite how it cohered. So if somebody were to ask, like, explain this part of the faith or explain this aspect of Christian practice, I could have said, like, this wise person says thus and such, and, like, this holy person says blah, 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 and right, you know, you experience this quite a bit. Folks have a variety of quotes on tap, and they're like, yeah, this quote seems to apply, and that quote seems to apply, but then you kind of get yourself tied up in knots, because the saints say some seriously intense things, like, really, like, wow. Does that apply here? You know, it's like, it'd be better that the entire world be uncreated than a man commit a single venial sin. You're like, bruvy, is that true? So you hear these things, and sometimes it complexifies your experience, and you're just, yeah, not sure. Okay, so while I was at school, my freshman year of college, I went to a lecture given by Eleanor Stump, who teaches at St. Louis University. She's kind of on her way to emerita, but she's still directing dissertations and blah, blah, blah. Okay. But at the time, she was preparing chapters for a book that she eventually published as Wandering in Darkness. And she gave a version of the chapter on love at Franciscan University my freshman year, fall semester of my freshman year. And I went, and like I toddled in, as I toddled into most things in college, just like, this is sweet, and I'm cool, and life is awesome. And I sat down, and it was as if, like, she was narrating my experience with a vocabulary and a grammar that I had never previously had access to. And I was like, lady, get out of my mind and heart. Yeah, because she just, you know, very patiently set forth principles and arguments and kind of furnished us with an account of St. Thomas's teaching on the nature of love. And I was like, yes, that's it. But it was beautiful because it kind of unlocked my experience. And I was able to identify my desires, not just serially, but like as a unit, kind of integrally. I was like, yeah, I want to be wholly given to the Lord. Yeah, I want to do it in a religious register. Like, I want it to look like worship. I want it to smell like sacrifice. I also want it to be great, and I don't want to shy away from that. Like, even if it's kind of a Teresian little thing type deal, I want it to be great little things. And I want love, you know, like, I want to be with people. Like, I want to have them. Not in a creepy way or in a possessive way, but, like, I don't want to, like, experience distance at every turn. Because everyone's like, yeah, like, you know what I mean? And I don't want to be able to, yeah. I want to be able to say yes. I want to think the same thoughts. I want to love the same realities. I want to be together unto ages of ages. And she's describing St. Thomas Aquinas and the nature of love. And I'm like, oh my gosh. Okay, so that's the material answer. Like, if you host Mystic Institute events, the chances that you encounter the truth, which furnishes you with a vocabulary and a grammar whereby to narrate your experience and enter more richly into the vocation to which God is calling you, are decent. Okay? Unless you, like, host all of your TI lectures on, I don't know, like, S5 modal logic. Maybe, I don't know. I just, okay, not into it. I don't even know if that exists. Yes! Let's go. Okay, cool. Been hanging out with Father Bonaventure recently. And by recently, I mean for the last 15 years. Okay, so, but I want to furnish you with what I call the formal answer. Okay, so not so much, like, results-driven as it is character-driven. And I want to focus especially on virtue. Sorry that I've been neglecting you. I just find this a somewhat awkward position to... Here I am, Colossus, astride the straight. Right, so I want to think especially about virtue as a kind of principle of integration. Okay, virtue as a principle of integration. So when St. Thomas lays out the Summa Theologiae, he says, let's talk about God. And then he says, let's talk about how you come from God and go back to God, for lack of a better description. Okay, so... the Summa Theologiae is kind of complete after Prima Pars question 43. You're like, this is a perfect treatise. But then he says, here's the thing. God created, and it's worthwhile to inquire further into the nature of his creation and the ultimate trajectory of his creation. So let's get into, and then he goes through creation, angels, sub-human creatures, human beings, like divine providence and governance. And then, like, the heart of the matter, or so it seems to me, is the second part, which he says, now that we've talked about God, who is the exemplar, let's talk about the image, which is to say, man. And specifically, how the image is made unto the exemplar, how the image is made to imitate the exemplar. And so for him, the moral life isn't so much a matter of like, all right, gents and gals, we're just going to trot out a bunch of rules, and I hope that you do your absolute darndest to follow them in turn. That's not at all what he, I mean, like he says, let me just furnish you with life. And the specific way in which he does that is through principles and arguments. He says, God, in his infinite loving kindness, accommodates his divine life to our recognition and reception. In less complicated terms, God makes himself such that we as human beings can share in his life. God, in his infinite zeal, that is to say, in opposing all manner of obstacles to the communication of his love, accommodates his divine life to the complexity of our human nature. All right? So he gives us grace, which is a kind of habit of being. He gives us virtue and gifts of the Holy Spirit, which are a habit of operating, one more so active, one more so passive. He gives us beatitudes and the fruits of the Spirit, which are themselves acts of perfection. God, in effect, gets into all the nooks and crannies of our human experience so as to suffuse our humanity with his divinity. We're not being pantheist or panentheist here because we're talking about a creature and an accident superadded to a creature. So for those of you who are worried about that, don't be. Okay. Guys over here like, I was worried. Okay. so what is it that actually is happening? Like, boots on the ground. Here, the ground is you, the boots being God's accommodation of divine life. Weird image. Just work with it. Like, what's actually happening in our mind and our hearts and our guts? Effectively, God, and here we're talking about our experience of life after the fall, which is our only experience of life. God is healing us and growing us, all right, so as to suit us for a divine conversation. And conversatio there doesn't mean just like chit-chat. It means the sharing of the whole of life. Okay, so this is the trajectory. It's not just that we're made to know and to love God. It's that we are capacitated to know and to love God, and that God gives us his own knowledge and his own love as the only sufficient principles whereby to participate in this conversation. Because we can think the same thoughts, and we can love the same realities, and we can do so with a kind of familiarity which is accurately described as familial. Like, we can be home there. Whoa, yeah. Which, like, when you think about it, is wild. So, the ordinary principle that we identify that effectuates this change in our life is virtue. Okay? And where does virtue lodge? I've said that it's a principle of operating or a principle of operation. But effectively, what virtue perfects is your desire. Okay? What virtue perfects is your desire. Now, some of you are out there thinking, like, there are intellectual virtues, and that's more so cognition than it is appetition. Are you running roughshod over these things? It's like, hey, easy there, chief. When Aristotle talks about virtue, he says it's properly so-called moral virtue, which is to say justice, fortitude, temperance, and the things associated therewith, because virtue, properly speaking, is about the heart. And by the heart, I mean the biblical sense of both will and emotions and our passions. Okay? We can identify intellectual virtues. Yeah, no problem. But they're less so virtues after a manner. Okay, background description. We're not going to get that today. You might get that later. All right? So when we're talking about virtue, we're talking about a kind of healing and growing of desire. So then the promise is that by exercising your agency as a human being, not just with the aspiration to share in the divine life, but the promise that it is being brought to bear at present is that you can come to desire yet more perfectly. And that you can come into the possession of a progressive, like, clarification and empowerment as it concerns your humanity. What do I mean by that? Basically, you were created good, and you fell. We all fell in our first parents, okay? Because we're present in Adam's nature, we're present in Adam's choice, we're present in Adam's loins. His sin is our sin. We have to claim that solidarity, otherwise we'll just be lamenting the fact that this isn't fair unto ages of ages. But we're about a more serious business. Because no, it's not fair, but neither is redemption. Okay, so if you want fairness, you can have fairness, but they are meager rations. If you want superabundance, you can also have superabundance, but you have to beg for it. Okay, not because God wants to belittle you or to denigrate you, because it's the only way in which to recognize his infinite majesty and to partake of it so that we can be ennobled in it. Sorry, I'm speaking too quickly. The basic point is this, okay? Our desires are bent, all right? To a certain degree, they're broken, and they stand in need of unbending or unbreaking, they stand in need of healing and growth. And the promise is that over the course of your life, you can come to trust your desires. All right, so what we're not saying here is like, do what feels right. In a certain sense we are, but that's for later. So if we were just to say, my desires are my desires, okay? Tolstoy has this hilarious description of Napoleon Bonaparte in War and Peace. He said to him, this is like a weird paraphrase, but he comported himself as if a man who could do no wrong, not because his comportment conformed to some standard, but because it was his comportment. Which is like a deep take saying, this guy thinks he's awesome. about to get beat. All right, so when we say like, when our secular contemporaries say like, do what feels right, they are effectively consigning themselves to the bent and broken trajectory of their desires. Okay? We have to be a little bit critical of our desires, but not critical unto ages of ages. We're not meant to live our lives at a distance, always wondering whether or not we can trust ourselves. God says, trust me, and in due course, you can learn to trust yourself. Because in coming to trust me, you get me, and I abide with you at the center, and I heal you, and I grow you, I unbend your desires, I unbreak your desires, I restore you, and impart to you the how much more of the redemption. Okay, so that's like, that's big. So the basic idea here is that if you want to come into an appreciation of who you are and what you're made for, you live your Christian life, All right, you pray, you make good use of the sacraments, you introduce some penance into your life, you engage in Christian friendship, you study the faith, you serve the material poor, et alia huius modi, as St. Thomas would say, and other such like stuff, right? But in due time, laying hold of those means to salvation, which is the end, that is to say, to life with God unto ages of ages, has a way of changing you, not fundamentally altering you, as if God said, like, this is the creative blueprint on which I will build out my creature. Never mind, redemption, let's scrap it and do something completely different. No. Redemption, there's a certain continuity there with creation. Because what God did at the beginning, he intends to do forever and always. All right? So like St. Thomas would talk about how Christ, the Word, is the pattern of creation, the exemplar of all created things. And he says this is one of the reasons for which it's the Word who becomes incarnate. Because the standard, as it were, or the type of creation, is the one who becomes human flesh so that we can see it in living technicolor and lay hold of it. Because the plan was never bad. Our appropriation of the plan was incomplete and sinful or vicious, but the plan was never bad. So, again, focus, Gregory. The promise is that virtue, in healing you and in growing you, can impart to you a kind of certainty and confidence that God is about a good work in me. Genuinely, sincerely, in me. It's not something that's always at a distance where I have to constantly criticize myself for fear that I will be taken in by a false promise. But I can just live. I can just live. I can just be myself. Which, as we all know, is kind of hard. Okay, so the promise here is freedom. All right, this is what I think we're meant to understand by freedom. Now, freedom, it's kind of like an analogical term, okay? So there are kind of low-grade expressions of freedom and high-grade expressions of freedom. How's everyone doing right now, heat and cold-wise? Good? Good? Okay, great. I just like see it blowing, and I'm seeing like a little chill run through the room, so I want to be sensitive to that. Okay. The TI is giving out free cardigans in the hallway. Just kidding. Okay. So freedom is an analogical term. In the sense that low-grade expressions and kind of high-grade expressions. In its low-grade expressions, it just means indeterminacy. Okay, so you're not fixed on one or the other option in life. You're free to choose. Like you go to Italy, you do the most important thing that one does when he or she goes to Italy, namely, you eat gelato. And like you can have tiramisu, right? Or you could have cappuccino, or you could have pistachio, which I'm told is pronounced pistachio there. All right, you can do those things. You are genuinely free, okay? Now, how is it such that we, amongst all the material creatures, are the only ones who evince this freedom? Well, it's because we, of all material creatures, I keep mispronouncing that word in a way that makes me sound oldie-timey. All of creation. Okay, so we alone, of all material creatures, have a spiritual nature, all right? We have a spiritual intellect and will, which kind of puts us on a trajectory towards infinity. I don't mean to overstate the case, but basically, our minds are such and our hearts are such that we will never be satisfied in our inquiry or in our embrace but with God. Okay? So you are ruined for life. Try hanging your heart on something created. It'll always bend and eventually break. All right? But that's a mercy. Because were it to bear the weight, you might start thinking that this was enough. It's not enough. It will never be enough. Quote, the greatest showman. Okay, so we have this indeterminacy by virtue of the fact of our superdeterminacy. Because we are fixed on God, we are left free with respect to created goods, okay? Because none of them corresponds fully to our inquiry and embrace, okay? But the hope is that our freedom would mature to a point so that we're not living our whole lives thinking like, let me leave my options open. Because that's a kind of poverty. Really, that's a kind of slavery, truth be told. Your intellect and your will are made for judging and loving, okay? Or for knowing and loving if the word judging causes you disquietude, okay? Judging here is a good word. All right, come to the Dominican House of Studies and learn to judge. Let's go. Okay, so you are meant to mature in your freedom, not so that you become more, well, this could go that way, but so that you become more fixed on the end. All right? A lot of people will use images with like musicians or athletes. I'm going to take an example from athletics. LeBron James, okay? Like, LeBron James has grown up in North Akron, And at the age of 11, let's say he had like lots of options in life. Not only could he have played other sports, apparently he was a pretty good football player, but he could have pursued different avocations. From what I understand, Akron offers a variety of possibilities. You could have been a drug lord. You could have... Like, he may have been very successful at that, given his build, right? But as he got good at basketball, with all due respect to people here from Akron, okay? I went to Steubenville, which is of a similar sort. Okay. LeBron James, like, had options. But as he came to appreciate how good he was at basketball and what that entailed for his life, like, what he was capable of, he probably came to recognize that those options were no longer live for him. Because he had a sense of the gift that he had been given, and then he wanted to steward that gift, to treasure that gift, to train, to discipline, to grind, and then to attain to the height of his craft. Okay, so like, you could say like at the age of 11, he's got all these options, but by the time he arrives at, what are we now, 40? Is he 40? That's incredible. But at the age of 40, he's got his wife, he's got his three kids, he's got his craft, and he's got his, you know, like life pretty well fixed. Okay, now, I think this fixity will sometimes scare us on account of the fact that it sounds like something boring, or potentially unsatisfying, right? But the fixity that we're talking about in heaven is a fixity effectively in God. I was actually just working on blah, blah, blah. I was reading St. Thomas Aquinas on the vows, and he talks about how the vows are an anticipation of beatitude precisely in this sense. Happy, says St. Augustine, is the constriction which binds us to the good, all right? Happy, the servitude which enslaves us to the Most High, all right? So, when you use your freedom to set certain things aside so as to give yourself more wholly to what matters most, in a certain sense, you become thereby fixed. But that is a greater freedom. There is no greater freedom than the freedom of the angels and saints in heaven. That's freedom. That is to be completely and perfectly oneself, yourself, their selves. So, on this analogy of freedom, we start with options, but we end in fixity. And the terminus is a kind of self-possession. You can finally have yourself. You know, like you spend a lot of your life feeling like you're slipping through your own fingers. You know, it's like 1:30 at night and you can't fall asleep because you've been thinking through this conversation that you had with this gal and you said this thing and then that thing and you thought there was some misprision and as a result of which it kind of got sour and slightly awkward and you would have done it better, but you don't have that time travel thing that the protagonist of About Time does, so you can't fix it. But like, if you were to over-explain, it'd probably be creepy, so you probably should leave some time. But then you're thinking about the fact that she hasn't texted back and it's been like 7 hours at this stage of the game and usually her cadence is like 3. And so it's just getting to the point where it's like, bruh, you know? Deep breaths and 6 milligrams of melatonin. You know, it's like we've been there. Like, we've all been there. But we can feel our own lives just kind of like freaking out around us like a kind of cloud of electrons. It's like, what if you existed in a stable state, you know? What if it were like the Bohr model, you know? let's go biology. Okay. right? That'd be incredible. And that's the promise. That's the actual promise. Not so that you can become like smug and self-assured, like, I am so self-possessed. Shut up. You know, like, no one cares. The purpose of being self-possessed is that you can make of yourself a gift. The purpose of self-possession is self-gift. So you can be present to people. So at the end of the night, you're not like fretting about how many hours of sleep you're not getting. You're conscious of the fact that like this dude just broke up with his girlfriend and he's bleeding. And my job, not so much my job, but my joy is just to like be here. And smoke some like really bad Black and Milds, you know, because that's all he's got. Although the wine flavor, you know, it's like a pleasant lip gloss, you know, just think of it that way. So it's like, this is us. Like, this is what we're aiming for, hoping for, shooting for. Because the purpose of human life is to be with. As far as I can tell, there's nothing further. But the good news is that's enough. To be with God. And to be with each other. All right? And so self-possession, I'm getting back into creator mode. Self-possession, self-gift unto genuine communion. Like, that's the promise, all right? So, as we come to discover, though, this transformation only ever transpires by way of commitment, by way of engagement, all right? Self-gift always entails some manner of death. It always entails some manner of sacrifice. And I don't say that to be like overly dramatic. Look at Father Gregory with his devastation discourse, being all melancholic again. No. I think that corresponds to all hearts, regardless of whether you're melancholic or choleric or sanguine or phlegmatic. I just like, you need to die. Unless a grain of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it remains a single grain. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. That's the only way through. Okay? So the purpose of self-possession, self-gift is to make these concrete sacrifices, to live these concrete deaths so that we can commit, so that we can engage. And in any vocation, you're going to experience that. There's this guy who is emeritus at Duke University named Stanley Hauerwas. He has what he calls the first rule of marriage. And it goes like this. You are going to marry the wrong person. Okay? There's nothing else. That's it. That's the whole law. Okay? So you can, in a certain sense, despair at present of your ideal life. Just be done with that. You have no ideal life. You've got this life. And I know a lot of people are going to tell you to like live the best version of it. I have no idea what that means. Okay? A none. But I know that in this version of it, you can make of yourself a gift. You can die a beautiful death. You can sacrifice for someone whom you love. So like, in your conversation, we are human beings, spiritual nature, sure, but embodied. And we experience that as a limitation because when you have a conversation, at best, you can talk to like one person or like maybe two people. By the time you get to like five or six, it's somewhat diffuse, dispersed, and you feel like you're losing them, you know, because then you're thinking too much about who's speaking at what rate and the cadence, blah, blah, blah. You get in your own head and you're thinking about imbalance and indelicacy and yada, yada. But it's like when you've got just one person, it's like, bruvy, we can talk about it all day long. You know, because I can get out of me and you can get out of you and we can get into the thing and not think so much about the percentage of time that each of us speaks, but like the interest held by the object, which draws us both in its wake. But in order to do that, I have to commit. I have to be like, I'm going to have this convo with Aiden or I'm going to have this convo with Ronan, you know, and it's not like something patronizing or kind of let me bless you with my presence, you know, like because I've experienced both of these dudes is genuinely delightful while on retreat at the University of Pittsburgh in kind of hilarious fashion. Ronan. He will end your Discord server. This guy, man. You think you've met a troll before? You haven't met a troll before. None like Ronan. Yeah, and he'll do it by citing ecclesial documents. You haven't seen it coming until it comes, okay? So in all of our engagements of whatever sort, when we commit, we tell to the other, like, you're worth it because you're beautiful. Like, you're precious, you're wonderful, and I delight in your company. I'm not, like, trying to be here. You know, like, you're not my charity case. You're my joy. That's awesome. Like, all of us want that. Because when you get the impression that somebody's trying too hard to like you, you're like, it's okay. It's okay. I'll just lay in the gutter. It's fine. Yeah, I'll just go drink oat milk. You know, it's like, so it's totally fine. You know, it's worse. Okay. So this is the shape that your life takes, okay? That you are made to make commitments. That you're made to, like, expend your life with engagements of a certain sort. And they're not going to be the best. You know, like you're going to be like, you know, time for a Thomistic Institute lecture or whatever on a Thursday night. And somebody's going to be like bop over and be like, hey, really cool, fun, spontaneous thing, which involves mild imprudence and maximal enjoyment. And you're like, yeah, bruh. You know, like that's a death. That's a sacrifice. But that's a sacrifice that prepares you to give yourself yet better with each passing year, with each relationship that comes in turn. So I think that like, you know, you can use the philosophical language whereby to describe the phenomenon, but the fact is that we are conjugal animals, social animals, political animals, and our perfection is only ever to be attained together. That's the way in which we're made. It's not so much an expression of need or indigence. Like, I would go it alone, except for the fact that you're a better, like, farmer than I am, so I'm going to, you know, prey upon your surplus so that way I can read more books. No. We're not talking about it in that sense. Like, we only ever make sense in community. We only ever fit in community. The man who lives apart, says Aristotle, is either a beast or a god. And the chances that you are a god are exceedingly small. Okay? So, we are perfected. We are made for community. And so we have the opportunity throughout the course of our life to choose for that. So it's just the metaphysical case. But you can lean out in resentment and try to hold off all commitments and engagements at arm length, treating your whole life like an elective series of options, opting in, opting out, as it befits your own present state. Okay? Or you can just give yourself to it. And your life might look like a big open wound at times. Because you're going to overcommit. We all do. I mean, maybe not all of us. He's being too autobiographical. Oh, no. Right? But in the process, you'll come to discover what you are and are not capable of. You'll figure out what the weight of your yes is and what the weight of your no is and what the real quality of your love is as you are able to impart it to one or two or three people. Okay? And maybe more. Who knows? That's for the Lord. All right? The rest is not our business. So, yes. That's the basic proposal, is that we're made to commit and that we're made to engage and that our lives are not going to be ideal, not optimal or maximal, but they can be good. And they can be good with these people. So here we go. These are my like practical encouragements, and then we'll go into a time of question and answer for as long as you see fit. Like when it comes to planning a talk, for instance, I would say plan a talk for someone. Don't plan a talk for everyone. I think about this often when I preach. When I try to preach to a whole room, it's like trash. But when I say like, let me just preach to one person, then it can often translate to the experience of other people. But like, life has to build an interpersonal bridge, or we all just like get lost in our own weird subjectivity. Okay, this is for intersubjectivity, but you have to be able to host an event for a person. Okay, and sometimes like a decent way to go about that is by checking in with your own desire. Like, what do I actually want to hear a talk on? So like, yeah, you can go on the internet and you can look up whatever most recent video like Bishop Barron did or Father Mike Schmitz did and say like, ooh, this is what the kids are talking about, so maybe we should host an event on that. But if you're not interested in it, then maybe choose something else. And it can even be like a little bit weird. That's totally fine. You know, like I relish the opportunity to receive weird invitations. It's like, hey, would you talk about like the connection between philately as a hobby and like the mating habits of Atlantic salmon? It's like, I was hoping you'd ask, you know. So next year, Veritas, let's go. Right, so lead with love, like lead with genuine interest, all right? Because you're going to be able to call people or like invite people into that love. C.S. Lewis has this famous line. He says, in order to have friends, you need to want something more than friends. Okay, so like I can't come up and be like, I don't have any friends. Would you be my friend? I suppose I could do that, but the chances that it works out are like low. But if I come up and say like, hey, like what are you scrolling through? He's like, oh man, I'm playing Candy Crush. I know that game hasn't been cool for like 15 years, but like the thrill of exploding fruits, it just gets me. And I'm like, I too am into exploding fruits. Like we should talk about this for the rest of our life, okay? And in heaven, right? So like if you are able to be honest about what you love, you're gonna find other people, provided that they are able to be honest about what they love. Because like who gives a rip about the Cool Kids Club? Who gives a rip about it? I'm here for like whatever this club is. we are very cool and super well adjusted. You know, it's like, okay. Trying a little too hard there, Chief. So lead with interest, okay? The world doesn't need clickbait. All right, the world doesn't need clickbait. The world needs love. And specifically your love. So you can come together around genuine interest. But that means that you have to be curious about what you genuinely love. Like, what is the Lord doing in your heart? What is he stirring up? What is he provoking? What types of questions is he prompting? And ask them. Ask them of your TI speakers. Ask them of each other. Ask them in a community into which you are drawn thereby. And I think that, like, as is the case with my experience, and so is already probably the case with yours, you'll find that the Catholic intellectual tradition will furnish you with a vocabulary and a grammar to live your life, right? Because oftentimes we feel like at a distance from ourselves. I don't know, maybe this is just me, but, you know, it's like, I wish I could just be myself, you know, like at certain points or at certain times. And I think often of this painting by a pre-Raphaelite named William Holman Hunt, where it's like Christ crowned with thorns and he's knocking at a door. There's no handle on the outside of that door. The implication being that it is the person within who must admit him to that inner sanctum. That is true. But I also think that the reverse image is true. I think that a lot of us are knocking at the doors of our own hearts. We're in this process of healing. We're in this process of growing. And as a result of which, we're in the process of discovering who we actually are and what we're actually for. We don't have to be overly existential about it, but we can just be, again, curious and honest. And I think part of the soul of prayer is to ask that of the Lord, not to do so in a kind of solipsistic navel-gazing way, but to do so broken open to who he is. Because like, he wants to tell us who he is because it is wildly applicable to who we are. All right, God, in the revelation of his only begotten Son, also makes us known to ourselves. All right, so we're knocking at the door of our own hearts, asking to be admitted there to the center so that we can abide with God who delights to be with us there. So the Catholic intellectual tradition can provide you with a kind of vocabulary and grammar whereby to live your life and interpret your life. I talk about this probably too much, but there you go. Everyone's got their hobby horses. I think about life in this way. It's like you're living it, okay, and then you're interpreting it. And there's always like a little bit of distance between the living and the interpreting. And the question is, what do you do with that distance? Okay, there are some folks who just get so twisted up in knots about the fact that this is a serious affair that I think they get too close to their experience. You know? It's like, if you've read Chesterton's Orthodoxy, Chapter 2, The Maniac, he talks about how, like, these folks, their logic is impeccable. They're just living in a narrow frame. They're living in a small circle. They don't need more arguments. They need an invitation to a wider world. You know? And it's hard to communicate that without sounding condescending or, like, patronizing. It's like, bro, we're going to be okay. You know, but it's like, are we going to be okay? You know, like, is tobacco consumption immoral? Because, like, right now, I don't even know if I can have this conversation with you because you're smoking a cigar and it gets me, like, really, you know. So it's like, hey, we're going to be all right. The smoking is happening. The conversation is also happening. Apparently, they can coincide. All right, so, just kidding, but seriously. Okay, so some people, they just get so close to their life that it kind of takes all the air out of the room. There's meant to be some air in the room. But by the same token, we're not meant to live at a great distance. And this is why, for instance, like, I'll dabble in irony. I'll be, like, a little bit cute, sardonic, and caustic at times. But I try not to be too much so. Because, like, you know those people who only ever speak in ironic terms? You have great difficulty knowing, like, what he actually thinks and what he actually loves. There are times where I just, like, lay hold of the dude's shoulders and say, like, what are you saying? You know? Because I want to love you, but, like, I don't know who you are because I don't know what you're saying. You know? So, okay, so that's too far. Then what does it mean to live at this distance? I think it means to gain some perspective on our life. I was just talking with somebody about this David Foster Wallace lecture that he gave at Kenyon College called This is Water. Like, the point is a little bit of displacement, because we're all accustomed to living at the center of our own universe, and we fall into habits of thinking that we in fact are at the center of the universe. But the Catholic intellectual tradition, in giving us this vocabulary and this grammar, it can affect a kind of displacement, whereby we get just enough distance on ourselves to recognize the fact that this isn't the center, all right? Except insofar as God is there. And then it becomes the center. And the point of the displacement is ultimately worship. And it's in worship that we get out of these patterns of, like, back and forth, push and pull, dialectic, he's getting more attention than I am, I ought to be getting more attention than he is, blah, 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 thus and such. And we can learn to revel in something that actually has a claim on our whole life, for which we are made, both in inquiring and embracing. So I think, like, to Mystic Institute, you could do it, you could not do it. You're free. You know, like, you could get to Sunday and be like, yeah, that was a cool thing, but I also am totally overwhelmed by this upcoming year and I'm actually going to quit. You know, like, you are still precious. You are still beloved of the Father. We can still hang out, okay? You're just going to have to come to a TI event. just kidding, but seriously, okay? But like, as you come to an appreciation of how your life shapes up, think about it in terms of desire. All right, you're asking the question, like, who is God? And in turn, who am I and what do I love? But I'm going to have to tap in. I'm going to have to be curious. I'm going to have to be honest if I'm going to submit that to his healing and growing grace. But it's only in being curious and in being honest and engaging, that is to say, committing, like, embracing the relationship which God has in store, that I gain access to that. Because if I'm always at a weird distance, you know, kind of bopping in, bopping out, and failing to make of myself a gift, then I'll never live my life. And I just want to live my life, all right? Even if by comparison to other lives, it's modest, it's humble, it's small, it's hidden, who gives a rip? It's in the mystical body, all right? And thereby it is precious to God and to those whom God has given you, whom he has entrusted to you, with whom he has enriched your life.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.